Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And boy, I'm really happy to bring you these interviews today because they're very exciting people, starting with everybody's sweetheart, Sean Brock.
And before we forget, we should, of course, wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, right.
We almost forgot that because it's still a few days to go, but we'll be on our way to visit with our son and daughter-in-law and grandchildren for Thanksgiving ourselves. We hope wherever you go, wherever you dine, you'll have a wonderful time. We're sure you will. And now back to Sean Brock, who recently made his mark in the world of publishing as well as his mark in the kitchen
with a wonderful book
called Heritage.
Before we came on air, I asked Sean Brock why all of a sudden everybody is opening a Mexican restaurant, and it sure seems that way. You just did that in Charleston, right?
Yeah, about a little over a month ago, we opened a restaurant inspired by the culture of Mexico, and it's honestly been one of the most fun things I've ever been a part of.
We're all going to be in at the Latin American 50 Best in Mexico City next year, right?
Oh, great.
Yeah. Anyhow, but what we're really talking about, like, although I could talk about your restaurants forever, on Grady's and Husk, now your Mexican restaurant in Charleston, and also another Husk in Nashville, which is a thriving, newly thriving food community. But you also have another first, which is your very first cookbook called Heritage. Explain what the title refers to, because there's so many ways of interpreting it.
To me, that word means so much. And I think one of the great things about that word is it means something different to each person. And to me, it's the idea of something being passed down, something beautiful that's worth passing down, and something that needs to be preserved and, most importantly, celebrated. And to me, it's where I'm from. And it's how I grew up and how lucky I am to been able to grow up that way, and my desire to share it with everyone else, to pass it on to the next generation.
Well, now, you didn't actually grow up in the Low Country, which is what this book's about.
Well, the book was originally supposed to be only about the Low Country, and the more I started writing, the more I started to realize that that was a big part of my life, but it wasn't everything. You know, I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains in Virginia, and that was a really unique experience. As far as food goes, the food there is very, very unique, and the food of my family. And the more I started writing, the more I realized that that also needs to be a big part of the book. And so as you read through it, hopefully people will see that it's really kind of like documenting my journey as a chef and as a person and everything that went into that. And certainly growing up in Virginia was a major influence on my cooking.
Right. I have this funny thought in my head a lot of times. I never did ask you. Have you ever thought about what everything would be like if you didn't have this connection to Southern cuisine, which happened to be on the rise at that time?
Yeah, it's the reason I'm a chef. The great thing about it is the pride that comes along with really understanding the importance of embracing where you come from. And that sense of pride fuels my cooking and certainly the decisions that I make, and I feel very, very lucky to realize that. And that is something I'm very, very thankful for.
Yeah, but Sean, the first restaurant you opened, and we met you for the first time in an alley outside of the first restaurant that you opened, McCready's wasn't exactly known for traditional Southern food. People said, there's this really crazy man with the restaurant up an alley, and he's doing really innovative things that nobody else has ever tried to do in Charleston before. So talk about that transition just a little bit.
What's cool about the McCready's is it's a platform for me to be creative and to exercise that part of my mind. And luckily, we get to do it with the amazing products that are indigenous to the Low Country, and the plants and the foods and the dishes that belong there and have so much meaning to that area. And the McCready's for me is a way to kind of push it forward and look at it in a futuristic context. And
in a way, McCready's is simply a different expression of the way that a chef can tune in to these traditional ingredients.
Yes, it's my creative outlet, and it's my platform to try and move it into a more modern direction, and that's something that makes me really, really happy. I love modern cooking as much as I love traditional old Southern cooking.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I find extraordinary about you, your style, and this cookbook is how you manage, which is a really difficult thing, to blend all or inform all the old ways and the old ingredients with a contemporary attitude and vision. It's not easily done.
Well, it all stems from respect, an intense way of researching. And to me, in order to move a cuisine forward, you have to have a true and honest understanding of its past. And that's a lifetime worth of work. And I love that challenge. And it's what keeps me going every day. But I feel like the greatest form of flattery and respect is moving something forward based on your love and care of the past. That's kind of a very specific spirit. And I think if you think about it, that's the spirit that formed the cuisine, that made it what it was. And I'm just hoping to be able to carry on that spirit.
Now, one of the fascinating things are the characters you describe, the people from whom you buy these wonderful things that you cook with, including what you say is perhaps the world's best egg, and the wonderful microclimates of places like Wadwalla Island.
Oh, I love that. Yes.
Where you can get things that you didn't know they even existed because you thought they probably died out by now.
Yeah, well, the driving force of our cuisine is the people that produce it and the ingredients themselves. And once you realize that, then the work becomes much easier. Once you take the time to find those very special producers and to get to know them as a friend, you have a different respect for their products once you see the work that goes into it and the thought and care that it takes to produce such a special product. And that causes you to handle it in a different way. It causes you to handle it with an incredible amount of care and respect that can only be achieved, in my opinion, by spending time with those producers and getting to know them and really celebrating what they do.
Your book is organized. And, oh, by the way, let me compliment you on the photography. I mean, you didn't do the photography. The photography is brilliant. A lot of these product shots look like abstract art, fine art.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, you divide the book into chapters, and each chapter is a venue, the garden, the mill, the yard, the pasture. I've never seen it used that way, and I think it's a very effective technique.
Oh, thank you. I wanted it to be sort of organized based on where they come from, and I want people to think about that, because that's how I think about things, and that's what's affected my career, is really understanding where things come from. And if you organize it that way, then hopefully when the reader is flipping through the book, when they're in a specific chapter, their brain is in a specific place. And hopefully that'll, you know, trigger some nostalgia or bring back some memories, make people see it in a different light. I didn't want to just throw a bunch of recipes together, you know, and trying to figure out the best way to organize it was really tough.
Yeah,
and I'm really happy with the way it came out.
Yeah. And two other aspects of this book to point out is, there are many aspects to point out, but I want to call attention to the sidebars or bars of some sort. You have highlighting the ingredients from Carolina rice to, what are some of the other ones you do?
And there's Benny and there's all kinds of
the Benny's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, except I have no hope in hell in getting any Benny on a star at a pod. But anyhow, then you also, in addition to that, you have, what do you call these? I mean, these are things that really would tempt me, like how to roast a pig, and including every little detail of setting up the pit and the whole thing. And then you had shrimp boil. I mean, they're just things. These are special events and lifestyle events that you highlight that make people tempted to go out and try it.
Yeah, and I could have easily just written that as a recipe, just like the rest of the dishes in the book. But there are some things that need more of a narrative, that you kind of need to think a little bit more about. You'll notice, like, a lot of those things, there's not measurements or recipes or the standard and traditional way of creating dishes from a book. I wanted it to be more of this sort of idea of this is what I've learned over the years about this tradition that I really love and adore. And I feel like that was a neat way to create a storytelling aspect to it all. And people have really fallen in love with that. And it's really affected a lot of people in the way that I'd hoped that it would. And people are just seeing that it's all about having fun. It's all about trying new things, creating their own tradition.
Yeah, you have a lot of emphasis on entertaining, like here's the how to set up a whiskey cocktail station for a party. But entertaining is part of the whole ambience of the Southern personality, isn't it?
Yeah, we just love to entertain, and we love to tell stories, and love to create memories and share things with people. And entertaining is something that brings me a lot of joy.
Well, I'm gonna do a test for you pretty soon, not right this minute, because one of the things that I've come to despise is pimento cheese.
Oh, no.
I have, you know, since our kids live in South Carolina, I've had more than my share of pimento cheese. Also, throw in their sweet tea, but I'm sure that yours is probably gold standard of pimento cheese.
You want to be careful. They're probably going to set up a special barrier in the Greenville-Spartanburg Airport, and you'll have to retract everything you said before they let you in.
Well, no, I've been to enough grandparents' days at school, our grandkids' schools, to understand that many, many people in the South do not eat at the standards that Charlestonians do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a major Herculean effort to be able to pull back some of these traditional recipes to a standard, like the kind of standard that you apply.
Well, it's something that I'll strive for my entire life. And that journey to trying to accomplish that has really taught me a lot about myself and a lot about the importance of food and the importance of celebrating a region's traditions. And I just think it's one of the most fascinating things that you can try and understand.
What did you learn new about yourself? Because you've been at this for quite some time now.
Well, that's the beauty of cooking, you know. It teaches you so much about life.
You're not going to share what you've discovered about yourself. I mean, I'm very familiar with it, with the public image. I just wonder if you'd give us a secret clue as to what you've learned recently about yourself.
Well, I think the most important thing that I've learned in the last couple of years is being very, very proud of your family and its traditions and being proud of where you come from. I grew up in a very rural place that's stricken with poverty, and it can be a depressing place.
I'm familiar with Appalachia. I know it, yeah.
Yeah, and throughout high school, all I wanted to do was get away. And now, all I want to do is find a way back home. And it's amazing how that just happens when it's supposed to. And if you let it happen naturally, then it's a very special moment.
Yeah, I think it's part of maturing, growing up and maturing. No matter what you do, if you cook or you don't cook.
Exactly.
Now, one treasure in this book that I think everybody should pick up on, since it's a hot subject now, is I adore your pickles. I think last time we were at Husk, I OD'd on pickled green tomatoes.
I did the same thing yesterday.
Did you?
Well, you OD'd on Van Winkle bourbon.
Yeah, exactly.
I did that too.
Green tomato pickles at the same time, one in each hand.
The larger chapter is one that's very important to me, and one that means a lot to me, because that's how I grew up. We spent a lot of time preserving the harvest and getting ready for the tougher months, and all of my childhood memories are meals that came from the basement, that came from my grandmother's cupboard, of all these beautiful preserved foods and traditions that have a very specific flavor that becomes something that you crave, becomes something that you are addicted to and that you need. And all those recipes in that section are ones that I've been working on for a long, long time, and things that my family passed down to me, but also new developments within our kitchens. And that chapter, the larder, is probably one of my favorites.
That sort of leads us to this two-page My Manifesto. And I'll just invert things here. And the very last manifesto, whatever you call it, is he who dies with the biggest pantry wins.
That's one of my major goals as a chef, is filling up that pantry. Because if you fill up your pantry with the traditional foods that belong in your area, in your region, you're just stockpiling it. You're squirreling it away. And the more stuff you have in that pantry, the more you have at your fingertips, the more dangerous you are. You know, like when you're cooking, you always know that there's tons of artillery of flavor in that pantry, and that's something I learned from my grandmother.
Yeah, your grandmother was really important to you, from what you say.
Yeah, certainly, and I feel very lucky to have been blessed with the grandmother that I had. She was that storybook Southern grandmother, and was just a master of many, many things, and I looked up to her my whole life.
One recollection I always have or association with my grandmother is watermelon rind pickles. And
yes.
Which, you know, I guess they're kind of coming back in style. But I just, as a clue to the kind of creativity you bring to this book, I mean, you're resurrecting all kinds of old ways and old products, the traditional heirloom things, but you make this watermelon rind pickle into the most glorious looking mostardo I've ever seen in my life. I want to taste that, Sean. I want to eat it right off the page.
It's pretty tasty.
Which brings us to, if I wanted to make this, let's talk about level of difficulty in reproducing your recipes.
Okay, yeah, you know, when I put the book together, I wanted it to be useful to everyone. I want kids to cook from that book, and I want professional chefs to cook from that book, but what I don't want to happen is for people to look at things and get nervous or think that they can't do it. One of the great things about cooking, and I talk about it in the book, is trying something and making a mistake, and trying something and messing it up. And what you'll learn from that experience is, you know, you can't put a value on it. That's the way I learn. That's the way I've always learned from the first day that I started cooking. And that's, you know, I put some difficult things in there because I want people to push themselves. I want people to make mistakes and learn from them. That's one of the great things about being in the kitchen and playing around.
Right. Well, I think there's a big learning curve from the front of the book to the back. Is that how it was organized? And there are some things people are going to be able to do and some things people are not going to be able to do, but it's very important for them to know that those things are out there.
And, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and of course getting a hold of that's another effort. I mean, you've spent how many years learning how to source your ingredients and it shows.
Yeah, and one thing that I've started to realize about the book is it's more about the journey of trying to discover the ingredients, your area, and the ingredients that belong there, and the food that you're born to cook, and the food that makes you the happiest and brings you the most joy. I don't expect everyone to have a pantry like I do, but I wanted to document mine to inspire people to create their own.
Well, hope that people get this book. Again, it's a Sean Brock heritage. I wonder how much of this fame you can live with, Sean Brock.
I try and be the simplest and humblest person around. And the way I was raised, you know, you just keep your head down and try as hard as you can every day. And sometimes good things happen when you have that attitude. I'm very, very grateful and very thankful. And that also is a driving force to my work ethic. I feel like I'm very, very lucky. And I realize that every day, and it makes me get up a little bit earlier and go to bed a little later and try a little harder.
Well, listeners, I need to share something else with you. Is you're going to be impressed with this book. You're going to be impressed with the food if you taste it of this chef. One of the things that I always find so amazing is any time I'm in the vicinity of Sean Brock, I mainly want to go up and hug him.
That's amazing. That's awesome.
So that's the kind of person you are. And thank you for talking
that.
To us, Sean, and thank you for the
you
wonderful
guys are the
talk.
Best. So great talking to you.
You too.
Look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
We'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest is a most compelling food writer, Jennifer McLagan. Peter corrects my pronunciation for that.
From all the way down under.
And she has this genius for picking subject matter. And in her previous books are things like, let me see, one was Bones.
One was Fat.
One was Odd Bits. And now this one is a subject that people are finally just beginning to pay attention to. And she has a great deal of insight into it. It's called Bitter.
She's also back to one-word titles. She broke out of one-word titles with the last one, which was actually two called Odd Bits. Now she's back to only one. But it's a whole lot of fun.
We always love interviewing Jennifer McLagan. What have we talked to you about, Jennifer? Your books, Fat, Bones, Odd Bits. I always end up learning so much that I didn't even know that I needed to learn. And this one is really a marvelous book called Bitter. And I like the subtitle most, is A Taste of the World's Most Dangerous Flavor with Recipes. I love it. It's so dramatic.
Yeah, bitter can be a bit dramatic, you know, and bitter has its kind of dangerous side, so I wanted to make it kind of a little bit dangerous.
Yeah, what's dark?
It intrigue you into the subject, right?
The cover is dark, and you turn it over, and you've got, what is that, winter trees or roots?
End papers?
Right.
That's actually tobacco leaves.
Oh, yeah.
They've been made a different color, but it's actually tobacco leaves, which, of course, I use a little bit of tobacco dangerously in one of my recipes.
There are a whole lot of farmers in Kentucky and Virginia and North Carolina who want you to find out another use for tobacco.
Exactly. And it's something, you know, I learned that if you don't light it and breathe it in, that if you just ingest tobacco, it's not that bad for you because the acids in your stomach destroy any of the things that are toxic. And it's just kind of an interesting flavor to put into the truffles, the chocolate truffles and the panna cotta.
Now, Jennifer, let's get back something that I had never really considered thoroughly. And I think that you found a lot of surprises in investigating this. And we always say that there are four basic flavors or tastes, except we added another one. Sweet, sour, go ahead.
Salty. Bitter, and now, of course, we've accepted the Japanese flavor that was the taste that was discovered at the beginning of the 20th century, which is umami, that kind of savory, mushroomy taste. And, you know, I'd argue for fat. The Australians and the French believe that fat is a taste. I think we're kind of too limited when we box it down to four or five. You know, in the 18th century, they had 11 basic tastes. So
I feel like we can't
add a few more, right?
You know, I thought that was amazing, all those. But a lot of them, I think, are like combinations of or parts of, as opposed to...
Yeah, I guess it's how you know, it's a very hard thing to describe taste, right? But I think things like pungent, I think pungent deserves to be a taste on its own. I think soapy, metallic.
Yeah, soapy, I think so, too.
Yeah, you know, like a lot of people find cilantro, what I call coriander, soapy.
There's
that kind of soapiness to it.
Then you've got that wonderful stuff you used to make me eat in Kansas City called yucca. which tastes
soapy.
Which tastes for all the world like eating candle wax.
And you know what's really interesting too, Anne, about taste? Everyone is different, and that's what was so fascinating about bitter, because you really can't, I mean, we might all agree that something like bitter melon is really bitter, but there's a lot of other tastes in between that I will think are bitter, and you won't, and vice versa, and I think that's really what attracted me to the subject matter.
Yeah, it is sort of subjective, and you imply that taste, of course, there's this issue of taste versus flavor, but you imply that there are all these other senses involved in taste, and that's where I'm not quite sure we're on the same page. You talk about taste as it relates to sight
sound. What were some of the others?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Everything, I mean, of course, we always think of flavor as taste plus your sense of smell gives you flavor. And, you know, that's how you distinguish between taste and flavor, which is kind of, for a cook, a kind of messy way to distinguish. But, you know, I didn't realize how important sight was.
No, I didn't either.
And your hearing and your sense of touch.
Touch,
and
that was
extraneous things like, you know, or sounds, but even to the fact of what you're eating from or out of, or the utensil you're using, or the shape of your plate, can all subtly influence how you taste that food. It's really quite fascinating because, really, our sense of flavor is actually made in our brain.
Yes, you say taste is on the taste buds on your tongue, but also on other parts of your body, which I never knew about, other physiological sites, not just your tongue.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, one way to find out, the first is some in the back of your throat, and they're very sensitive to bitter taste. So if you take a very good quality olive oil, an extra virgin olive oil that has a bitterness in its profile, and you knock that back like a shooter, you'll definitely feel that on the back of your throat, that bitterness. And then, of course, we have them in our intestines and our stomach, and that's what gets our gastric juices going. And they've even discovered them that men have them in their testicles, but they're not quite sure what they're doing there.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they're doing there.
I guess I could start rubbing Brussels sprouts around there and see what happens.
No, but it's quite fascinating, and it just shows you how important bitterness is to the human body, right? Like, well, there's all these sites that are detecting bitterness throughout the body.
But go back to why. Because it's...
Well, I think the first thing is why we all have negative reaction to bitter. You know, we don't see it as a positive taste. Because if we have something really, really bitter, go up our face and want to spit it out. Because bitterness can signal something that's toxic that could kill us. And so there's that natural reaction. And with little kids and babies who have more taste buds, it's a very strong reaction. But if we get older, we learn that something like coffee, tea, or these bitter alcohols actually make us feel better. They change our mood. And so we get over the bitterness of them. We learn to love them, and we almost forget that they're bitter. I think most people kind of forget that coffee is bitter.
Now, see, that's one of the things that, you know, when you were talking about super tasters,
yep.
I'm always complaining to Peter about the bitterness in the coffee.
Have you done one of those tests, Anne? Have you tested to see?
No, I haven't, but I just, I'm not making, I know I'm the
not,
signs.
I'm not making the coffee any different, so it doesn't matter what she says.
No, but it's, you know, I say, I've got their little strips that I give to people sometimes, but I say, that's really only testing for one bitterness. What's interesting about bitter is there's like over 1,000 different chemicals that signify bitter, right? Where sweet and salty and sour are much more limited. We probably all agree on what is sweet, what is salty, what is sour. But we'll always be debating whether those celery leaves are bitter, whether the Brussels sprout is bitter. And I had a long argument yesterday with someone about how I find rutabaga, sweet. I find that bitter, and they find it sweet, right?
I don't understand why you don't like rutabagas.
It's my mother's fault. I think because I was a kid, she boiled it. And if you boil some of those vegetables, they do become bitter. And she boiled it and boiled it and boiled it and boiled it, like Brussels sprouts, until she could mash the Brussels sprouts.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a lot of boiling. And so I think my brain is still, even if it isn't bitter, my brain, every time I put it in my mouth, is saying bitter to me.
Now, I questioned your saying that babies and children, small children, have more taste buds than adults, because basically they have a singular direction called sweet.
Yeah, but they're also much more sensitive. I mean, like I said, it'll take a much smaller amount of any poison to kill them, so they have to be very sensitive to
bitterness. Well, it makes sense,
right?
That, but when I watch our grandchildren, I mean, as long as it's sweet, they don't mind much.
Yeah, but you know, it's also interesting, even though they do have that innate reaction of negative, if they come from a culture like the Italian culture where they're getting those bitter green and a lot of bitter vegetables from childhood, they don't have as negative reaction to bitterness as a lot of North American children do.
Hold on a minute. Let's make sure we remember to remind people that this is, among other things, a cookbook. So it's not just
yeah, there are recipes in there.
It's not just a scholarly dissertation on whether or not things are bitter and how you deal with them. It's called how do I embrace these, shall we call them, different flavors. Flavors that I never would try because the first time I tried them when I was a child, I didn't like them because they were bitter.
Yep.
To now saying, boy, we can make absolutely wonderful things with them.
Yeah, I mean, the recipes are so inventive, Jennifer. I just, what was it I just found in here that I wanted to put in my repertoire because it would be the way I'm ever going to make them in the future. It might have been one of your Brussels sprouts recipes, actually. I can't remember which one, but it just was so wonderful.
I also want to tell people when I called the book bitter, it doesn't mean I've done a recipe book with a whole lot of recipes that are going to taste bitter. Because only probably the bitter melon or a couple of them have quite a lot of bitterness in them. But they have bitter as a component, so in the end it balances the recipe. It's like when you add salt or a squeeze of lemon, you know, like you make yourself a salad and you add some bitter greens and it makes it more complex and satisfying, but it doesn't mean that you're just having a salad that's completely bitter, and the same with various other things. And I don't know why I didn't realize it ages ago that fat and bitter just go hand in hand. They're perfect, perfect complements. So if you have a nice fatty bacon dressing on dandelions, that subdues and suppresses the bitterness of the dandelions and makes the fat more digestible and more interesting. So by balancing things, you can make recipes that are just more satisfying to eat without being something bitter in your mouth.
Right, and you do things like, you would not think about bitter greens ravioli, which I think is a brilliant recipe.
Yeah, I like doing ravioli. I think that's often a good way to introduce people to things, and that's just kind of fun, you know, and it's quite easy to do. And then there's other things that are quite sweet in a way, like a chocolate tart, but make sure you make it with a quite a high cocoa content chocolate because you want it to be like bittersweet. You don't want it to be sickly sweet because then it's so much more satisfying and you only need a little slither of it and it's very full afterwards.
You know, I have a hard time finding Punterella here.
Oh, yes. It's not the... I mean, I have some things in there that you're going to have to work hard to find. You know, my big love is cardoons, but just in my supermarket up here in Toronto, it was in my supermarket yesterday, so it's starting to come in.
Well, I've had some farmers for the farmer's market raising it and bringing it in, and it's not the Punterella I find in Rome.
Oh, is it?
No,
it's not.
It
doesn't have those spears in the inside?
No.
And it doesn't?
It's just the first stage.
I get the one with the kind of asparagus-like spears in the center of the head, right? It looks like a big bunch of dandelions until you open it up.
Well, this is exactly what I was looking for, but that's not what these farmers are growing. And when I read your description of it, I realized that they're not really doing the Punterella that I know.
Yeah.
I thought maybe it was something you had to grow twice, like endive.
No, it doesn't have to grow twice. It doesn't need that double thing like endive, or it doesn't need the special handling. But they've got so many names. All those chicories that are all in the same family, they've got 100 different names, and people call them one thing, and they're not correct.
Just here, they show the basic ones in chicories, but there's so many varieties. I loved reading your recipes for radicchio, like radicchio and pumpkin risotto, but then I realized that what you really meant was squash.
Yeah, well, you know, you can take the girl out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the girl, right? And there's just some things, like for me, it's squash is, I don't know, it's just like a weird word. It's pumpkin and it's zucchini, or I even remember when we used to call them courgettes, you know?
So oh, yeah.
Sometimes I just slip back into the old vernacular, and pumpkin for me is, what I want you to use is really not a squash. I mean, I want you to use a nice, dry, flavorful squash. You know, a lot of squash are just a whole bunch of water, and there's not much interest in them at all.
True. Now, in addition to cardoon, which was my mother's favorite vegetable, by the way.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, my background's Sicilian, so why not, right? That's why about the Punterella, too. And why every spring we had dandelion greens.
Mm-hmm.
Without, I mean, I still pick them in my backyard.
Oh, good for you.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of those foods you can get, you know, it's so a la mode at the moment of forage.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting because that's how people always got their food, but everyone under 30 has suddenly discovered foraging. But that is one thing you can still forage quite successfully either in your front lawn or your neighbors, right?
Right. I mean, I have them in my backyard. I don't know about my neighbors. But the other thing that I found interesting is your recipes for celery, because you say so many people are averse to celery. Now, why would anybody be averse to celery?
You know what? I'm not a big fan of raw vegetables in general, and I'm not a big fan of celery. It's kind of crunchy and watery, and it's kind of a waste of time. But when I was at chef school, we used to always braise celery, and we would braise the whole head of celery, right? Cut it in half and braise it like in a beef stock and enrich it maybe with bone marrow. And it's cooked celery is so delicious, right?
Well, I don't know. We'd eat it ours with summer tomatoes.
Yeah, back into celery.
And we use celery in olive salad, which is a good thing to do. Celery in arugula leaf salad. Tarragon roasted celery, which sounds good.
Well, that's delicious.
Yeah, as I'm saying, I mean, I think the concept of the book is fascinating. I think that you could move on from here because there are all kinds of avenues open that are not closed, truly, besides the interesting facts that you encounter. The recipes are so inventive, just like all of your books, and so enticing. I mean, even the chocolate tart. Well, I think, as I said to you, you've done it again. I think this is a winner. And I think that it's one with lasting value here, and I can't wait to see what you're going to tackle next.
Well, thank you very much for your praise. I really appreciate it.
And have you thought of your next subject?
No, this is number four, and I don't know. It's hard work writing a cookbook. I don't think people realize sometimes how much work it is.
I did one, and I'll never do another one.
Yeah, I know you say that. I guess, I mean, I haven't had any kids, but, you know, people say that's what happens after childbirth. You'll never have another. And then you kind of forget, you know, oh, that horrible part when you're trying to do this and that. And, and then it's not till you start again. But I have to find a topic that fascinates me because it takes me about 3 years from when I start to when it's in my hand. So that's a long time to spend.
Well, that's sort of luxurious to have that much time actually on a cookbook. But it does. Well, good luck on this one and deserved praise for this. And I see it lining up for awards. It's that good.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Jennifer McLaughlin. Remember, listeners, it's bitter.
And don't go away because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Anybody who's listened to me for any period of time knows that I have some unusual interests. I mean, I love the animal world, but I'm also fascinated with the oddities that you find in the plant world. And so we latched onto this new book that came out called The Big Bad Book of Botany, The World's Most Fascinating Flora. And we're talking here to Michael Largo.
No, I'm not sure why co-host Anne decided that we should have a biology chapter.
It's not in botany.
Isn't botany part of biology, Mike?
No, it isn't.
I think it is.
I don't know. Let's say, yes, it's one of the sciences, but it's own field, its own science field,
There we go. Well,
biology is animals.
We decided you belonged in the program.
Okay,
because
well,
you wrote a book
great.
Of Big Bad Book of Botany.
Yes, and we're talking to Michael Largo, who has a history of really interesting books. And it's the kind of quirky stuff I like to read, Michael.
That's good.
Yeah, in this book, you really thoroughly researched this. You said it's sort of like a life's occupation, following plants and things.
Yes, I mean, it's been one of my passions as far back as I can remember. I guess, my grandfather teaching me how to plant tomatoes by poking my finger in the soil back from when I was a young boy. I was fascinated to watch seeds grow and learn about them, and I had a degree in environmental science and English, of course, to be able to write. plant book has been on my agenda for many, many years. My theory was this. I put myself through university as a nature guide. I mean, how much I knew about trees and plants. And what I found was that I worked at the conservatory where they would bust in inner-city kids, and most of them didn't know what a tree was. But what I tried to do was to show them that if you walked, say, comparatively into a room full of people that you didn't know, or you walked in a room where everyone had a name tag and you knew a little bit about them, you'd feel much more comfortable. So that's sort of the theory of the Big Book of Botany, is to try to introduce people to get to know the names of things so that they have more intimacy with it. Many years ago, everyone was so entwined with plants. They were our supermarket, our drugstore, and everyone knew that. And as time goes by, we've distanced ourselves from the history and the folklore of so many different types of very interesting plants and food commodities that we eat all the time.
Tell me how you selected the plants that you did for this book.
Well, there's so many different plants, so
yes.
It was a
that's
that was
why
a
I'm
challenge.
How did you,
you know, that was a challenge. And in the sense that I tried to pick a number of different plants that would be indicative of a different type of species of how they adapted. You know, plants have been around for 450 million years, so they've been around a long time. And think how disadvantaged they are as being stationary as they are wherever their seeds sprouted, that's where they are. So they came up with these amazing ways to propagate and also to protect themselves. And in so doing, some of those different biochemical changes that they used as survival means became our benefit. Some of them became foodstuffs for us. Some of them became medical ingredients to help us in medicine. But it's all from the biochemistry of these plants trying to survive and trying to a continuation of the species. That's really what I tried to do, is pick a mix of different plants to show this great, amazing variety that plants possess.
Now, here's the $64,000 question. Do vegetables feel pain?
Do vegetables feel pain? Well,
vegans don't.
I'm not sure, will, you know, rope me on this one. But I think that after doing this book, I did come away with a different sort of perspective than I had before, in the sense that they do react to a certain kind of stimuli. We cannot imagine, they have no brains, of course, and there's no nerve, anything similar to ours, but they absolutely have a reaction to stimuli. There's been some experimentation where they would put, say, a like plant in one patch without any invasive species, and in another patch,
right,
they would put the plant with an invasive species, and the ones that weren't worried about survival grew three times as much. So how did they know that? And we can't even imagine their level of consciousness or what, you know, we can't really call it conscious. We have to put a quote on that. But they definitely know their environment. And if they feel pain, it's not in the way that we would imagine pain to be felt. You know, they don't have a nervous system.
Right.
So I would say no on that. But their will to survive is very comparable to ours. So they have some other way, you know, they do want to survive.
These ingenious systems. Now, early plants, you indicate in this book, were hermaphroditic. Because you said, it struck me as so odd, you said, like, there weren't as many insects in that period for pollination.
Right. So they came after, you know, the plants came first, so they had to find a way to procreate. So they almost became, you know, just like the early biological species, like of amoebas, dividing themselves. They sort of imitated that, the earlier plants, but creating their own spores. The fern's a perfect example of that. We still have, that is a relic that when you look at a fern, that is an ancient plant. Over 300 million years, it hasn't changed at all because it perfected its way of self-procreating. Through its spores in a very complex way. But it came up with that. Then slowly but surely, as plant trees started to develop and they needed larger systems to hold their weight, phloem and xylem, different ways to bring nutrients up and down, and ways to attract pollinators. Again, all of this stuff for survival and for species.
Now talk to us about, because I thought your description of the avocado was more than arresting.
Right. There's another one of those very ancient species, and we all love, you know, most of us all love avocados. And when you make this avocado and you cut it in half, and most people just know there's a giant seed or a giant pit inside. But from a scientific point of view, it was a puzzle for many years of because, all, as I said, all plants try to disperse their seeds. They come up with some ingenious way, berries ferment so that birds will eat them and spread their away from the parent plant. And the avocado, with this giant pit or seed or its ovary offspring, could not, you know, you would wonder if it dropped where it is, it couldn't be dispersed by wind because it would then drown out the parent plant if it dropped where it was. So now we believe that it's called an evolutionary anachorism, which means that it one time had a symbiotic relationship with a giant creature, maybe a ground sloth, that could eat the avocado whole, you know, similar to where we, you know, as small as we would eat a peanut, and then as in its travels, dispersed the seed through defecation. But that whatever animal ate that avocado is no longer around, but the avocado still remains. So that's why we have that giant pit when we go cut our avocado and we look at that.
But they cannot propagate themselves. It has to be humans that do that.
Right. Well, see, now it's and it's, that's one of the other things too, which became very interesting in researching this book. Some plants. Since, like, they would attract a hummingbird. You know, we know that certain flowers, they have a symbiotic relationship.
Right.
Some of the beaks change to get to the shape of the flower over time. And some plants almost used us as well as their disbursement method. Came, and that's really with the foodstuffs. You know, they became edible. And I say became, again, in quote, because this is an adaptation period. But once they found that no longer had this, say, the avocado, this ground sloth to disperse it, fruit is poisonous to, the avocado fruit is poisonous to most birds. That's why you don't see it being pecked or anything.
Yeah, I thought
that
was
interesting. But for us, it's not. So we became its greatest disbursement mechanism. And so it became a relationship with us where we plant them because we love to eat them. And there's many things like that, like the eggplant as well. Really, eggplant belongs to the nightshade family, which is a nightshade is from belladonna, which is a very poisonous plant, extremely poisonous.
The sour tomatoes nightshade, aren't they?
Right, right. And, you know, the avocado still has a little tint of, I mean, like the eggplant still has a little tint of that poison in its early stages, in its flowering very first stages to keep people from picking it or eating it or animals
That's
from eating
clever.
It. And until that fruit is that its ovary or its fruit or its vegetable is germinated, and then that toxicity dissipates. So that's, say, plants are dumb or whatever, but that's an ingenious evolutionary method to make sure that its species keeps going on.
How do you say that coconut is the most amazing tree on the planet?
Well, I think if you had to pick asked me a question. If you had to pick one tree to survive, you know, I guess it wouldn't work well, the coconut, if you lived in Alaska. But
right.
Worldwide, belt of the subtropical and equatorial areas, you know, a huge amount of people living there. The coconut would supply everything that you would need, from fiber and hemp to make clothing. The coconut milk would be sufficient enough to survive. So, I mean,
coconut,
if I had to pick one plant to take with me, I would take the coconut tree with me if I needed to survive.
It's the big, in fact, I think that this coming month is going to be coconut month or something like that.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. It's a very, very popular flavor now, and it's also is being promoted for its oil.
Yes, correct. I mean, as I was saying, everything from oil, I mean, it's in cosmetics, helps health. It's, you know, it's just such a well-rounded plant. If people ask me what plant would have all-around usage, that one has really helped early civilizations, especially in those areas, survive throughout history. So that's one of the plants that I would put up there as the big one.
And you talk about broccoli as sort of a man-made invention. It's not a natural plant in a way.
Right. And that was the interesting thing, too. I mean, I love broccoli. I mean, it's so nutritional. It has so many nutritional values that it's almost a multivitamin in one floret. But it's traced back to this pre-Roman civilization, the Etruscans, were one of the first masters in the Western world, anyway, of agriculture. And the history of those people was they left some area that was drought-ridden, and they were determined to now try to alter the environment into a way that would they would never have that situation again of famine. And they became masters of irrigation. They became the first ones that would take wild plants and try to keep breeding them until they got to an edible product. So the parent plant, the broccoli, it probably was most likely some form of wild cabbage species, and they developed it into the broccoli that we still have today. So this is that's how long ago that was one of the first sort of foods that were made from man trying to create something that was edible. And in so doing, they didn't know that they created one of these powerhouse of vitamins in so doing.
Mike, I have two questions for you in conclusion, and you can take them in any order you like. I'm wondering, we just talked about cross-fertilization by the Etruscans to create broccoli, and that seems to be okay, but things that travel under the label GMO, which seems to me are really trying to reach the same goal of a bigger, better plant. Why is it that we frown upon that so much?
It's not that I keep saying to you, I don't agree with you at all, Robert. It's not that we're making a better plant. They're taking like fish genes and sticking it in corn.
Well, why don't we ask Mike what he thinks?
All right.
Well, I'm not so much of a fan of that. Say like the potato, splicing it with a pesticide.
Yeah.
That's not a food. And there are, is patents of certain potatoes that are not classified. The potato seed is classified under a pesticide, is patented as a pesticide, and it's a food. So I'm not such in favor of, you know, if we're creating a Frankenstein with some of these genetics of humans or animals,
yeah.
It's not allowed. But with plants, it's an open field.
Okay.
And I don't know really, you know, you could just take any example of an invasive species. You know, you take a water hyacinth and it's perfect in Southeast Asia. But when you put it, say, in the waters of South Florida, it no nutritional value and it just destroys the waterways and all the life that goes there. So in a larger scale, we're doing this now on a genetic level. The evidence seems to be pointing that we've already made these errors in other areas of bringing in invasive species.
You'd think we'd know better. Now, here's my last question. I'm worried about trees. Trees that have been growing for hundreds of years. You know, even in the United States for 100 or 200 years, and now they're being attacked by pests like the ash borer and other things like that, and Dutch elm disease, and they seem to be dying in droves, and it must be really worrisome to you.
No, it is in a sense, and you're trying to try to trace why. You know, we're here as a plant, as I mentioned, that had found an evolutionary path of adaptation that lived, you know, in a tremendous amount of time. I mean, there's a cypress in Florida that's 3,500 years old. You know, that's a historical monument. But a lot of these trees now, due to the changing environment, you know, we're adding different types of nutrients. I mean, different type of pollutants, not nutrients, pollutants. That they cannot adapt as fast to the changing environment. So that's why a lot of these older, you know, species, these trees are being attacked by different types of insects and different types of diseases that they were once resistant to. Plus also, the insect species adapts and mutates a lot faster, so they can adapt to the change in the environmental conditions and become stronger or become more ferocious or have other tools, while the plants take much longer time to do that.
Interesting.
So this is what's happening with the valuable forest lands that we have.
We could talk to you all day.
I'm thrilled with this book. Again, it's the big bad book of botany. That is an alliteration. Michael Largo is the author, and it's subtitled "The World's Most Fascinating Flora." And you know, it really is. It's so many. Every time I turn a page, I find another plant or vegetable or fruit that I'm totally entranced by. So thank you for talking to us. Thank you for writing the book in the first place. And thank you so much
for having me on your show. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And our final segment is an interesting story. It's a story not about a restaurant, not about a cookbook. It's really about a journey.
Wow, we have a real celebrity chef on the menu today, Chef Todd Gray. Boy, you're legendary at this point. How long has your restaurant Equinox been running?
We've been open for 15 years.
Which is a lifetime in the restaurant business.
It feels like it, but things are going well and looking forward to some very exciting upcoming years.
And it's a lifetime in Washington, D.C., where lifetimes are measured in 2 years, 4 years, and 6 years, so 15 years is really a lot.
That's true. That's right.
We're talking today about your unusual culinary twists on the Great American Road Trip. Why did you decide to do this? What exactly did you do? And tell us where you started and finished.
Sure. Well, it was a couple things that led to this exciting culinary journey. One, it right around my 50th birthday.
Life.
My wife thought it would be exciting, and she's been wanting to do this for many, many years.
And your wife, by the way, is?
My wife is Ellen Kassoff Gray.
Yeah, who's also a chef.
Well, she's our general manager here at the restaurant and my business partner and runs the front of the house while I run the back of the house.
Okay, so she's front of the house. All right.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
So we were sort of kicking off my 50th, and it happened to be simultaneously that I was going and did go to cook at Bouchain Winery in Carneros and was doing a culinary weekend with the great folks from Bouchain. And I was doing a wine dinner on a Saturday evening, highlighting some of my style from the mid-Atlantic out there in the wine country.
Uh-huh.
Started off in Carneros and a great weekend of cooking in the winery. And then we went back down to San Francisco, stayed in San Francisco for the night, and proceeded to snack on Dungeness crab and and eat all sorts of great chowders. And to find some of the greatest Irish coffees that I can remember, as I did not know that it was such a specialty to San Francisco. And we were, from there, picking up our RV and heading north. And that's as they say, that's when the bus came by and we jumped on. And we went from there and rolled all the way up, worked our way through Humboldt County, and
eat
worked our way up
there
to Northern California.
Eat a little cheese in Humboldt County?
Absolutely. We snacked on cheeses, and it was fun because on our way up, we were stopping at little roadside stands, and thankfully, this RV, you know, had a great kitchen in it, so we found ourselves, we were picking up local figs and plums and goat cheese and local baguettes, and we were...
It sort of makes you envious, doesn't it, when you see all that stuff on the West Coast?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've always had a love for Northern California. We honeymooned out there 20 years ago, and I've always had a special place in our heart for Northern California, especially the wine country and all of the great culinary scene that is out there and the great inspiration that you get whenever you go there. And so we worked our way up, going through Humboldt, and the couple of days into it, we found ourselves lost up near the Klamath River, and the very northern point of California, right below Oregon. And we turned one way and were supposed to go another, and I had a salmon fisherman's card that I was supposed to meet to go salmon fishing with my son, and my wife was thinking about it. Well, I called, and he said, "Don't you go anywhere else. You take a left and go up the road and turn here and turn there." And he had a smokehouse, and we stayed there.
Wow.
And he said, "You're going to stay here. You're going to love it." And we ended up staying 2 or 3 days, and it was one of the most unkept secrets in the world. It's just, I should say, one of the most least known about little gems of the world.
And what's it called?
One wonderful, wonderful family. These are Gold River Tours. This is the Bransimer family, and they are third generation of this beautiful, as we call it, the fish camp.
Oh, yeah.
And it was salmon fishing by day and salmon smoking and grilling by afternoon and evening and lots of great wine and music, and we had some grand time. But that's kind of one of the highlights. I'm catching the Chinook salmon out of the mouth of the Klamath, which fish range anywhere from 12 to 25 pounds. And
wow.
We'd bring them back, and you bring them up on a cutting station, and I don't think they'd ever seen a chef cut fish up there. They were used to doing it a whole different way.
And why?
So I cut it and cleaned it all up, and then they have a little, not a little, but a quite good-sized smokehouse, and we smoked all of our fish, and we grilled and marinated. We were making, they had never seen, of course, down in the fish camp, they were used to just grilled fish and, you know, put some corn on the grill, and they're very simple people. My wife was in the RV making smoked Chinook salmon beignets. So I was walking around this fish camp, and it was in the early evening, as it was sort of like fish camp happy hour, you know? And as people were having their early evening beverages, I was walking around passing out Ellen's smoked Chinook salmon beignets with remoulade, and people were scratching their heads and said, oh my God, we've never seen this, but then again, we've never had a chef set up shop here for a couple of days. So
sounds like fun.
It was a blast.
And a lot of characters, huh?
Oh, yeah, a very colorful group of people. Our trip then continued from there up to Florence, Oregon, where we worked our way up to Oregon, and we were, again, sampling up the road. We were hitting the great local barbecue stands and eating some wonderful local oysters that come right off the coast there in the south side of Oregon. It was absolutely beautiful. Again, all roadside, all good people. All just in true sort of the Pacific Northwest. It was a great experience.
Were you just sort of wandering and you played it by instinct or what?
No, we had the trip all planned out, and Ellen had planned out the trip as to how far we were going to go each day, and then we had a plan on the way back. We changed our plans because we loved the fish camp so much. We were there for 2 days, and then we were supposed to go celebrate out on Crater Lake for the 4th of July. We got all the way up to Oregon. We said we wanted to go back to the fish camp and catch more fish, so that's what we did. We went back down to the fish camp. We did more grilling and up foraging for wild fennel up in the hills. And
was they have wild fennel, did they?
Yeah, I was foraging for wild fennel and herbs that I would bring back down, and we would sprinkle all over the fish and throw it on the grill, and people were going crazy.
Did you make it into Oregon? Did you make it as far as Newport, Oregon?
No, we went only up to Florence.
Oh, okay.
And then
All right. We
turned back around up on the beaches of Florence and the big sand dunes, and again just snacking our way through the great part of the country. And we worked our way back down after we'd been at fish camp. We decided we would work our way back down. We ended up back down in Carneros on our way back out, and another great wine country experience. And just, it was a great run. So we had a lot of great food and met a lot of great people, and it was fantastic. It was great. And I think one of the coolest things, one of the great highlights of our trip was smoked all that fish, and we had it all cryovac'd. And my son, Harrison, who is a lover of great, great toasted bagels with smoked salmon and cream cheese.
Oh, yeah.
He says he was toasting a local bagel that we'd gotten in San Francisco with some cream cheese that I had picked up in Oregon from a small little dairy, and his smoked salmon that he had smoked the day before, riding down the coast of California eating a smoked salmon bagel. He said it was by far the best one he'd ever had in his life. I said, it was one of the highlights, and it was a wonderful trip, and that was kind of our culinary journey.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It was
now,
cool.
I mentioned that you own, you and Ellen own Equinox Restaurant in D.C. What other restaurants do you have?
Well, we have a cafe in the Corcoran Gallery of Art called Muse Cafe, which is a casual sandwich concept, panini, chilled soup or hot soups, coffee drinks.
They're joining or being absorbed by...
By GW and the National Gallery, yeah, and we are still down there to the sort of the middle of the fall, and then they're going to do a renovation and working towards discussions and potentially a new negotiation for a new concept in there.
Okay, and what about the Salamander?
Well, I am the culinary director for Salamander Hotels and Resorts, and as you might know, we opened up Salamander Resort and Spa. It will be a year ago this weekend. This weekend is our one-year anniversary. It is a wonderful 168-room luxury hotel.
Is this Sheila Johnson's place?
This is Sheila's place,
yeah,
absolutely.
We've always wanted to interview her. You know, stayed at her place, at the place she had for a brief period of time.
In South Carolina.
Somerville, South Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
it was called a Woodland Inn or something
like
that.
Yes, the Woodlands.
Woodlands.
Yes.
But she doesn't have that anymore, does she?
No, that's not part of the collection anymore. We released that property, and we have Innisbrook in Palm Harbor, right above Tampa. Fantastic golf resort.
We stayed there when it was owned by somebody else.
Did you really?
When our son was small. They still have the squirrel monkeys?
I think so, yes.
They're hysterical. They look like monkeys.
Yeah, and they, Sheila put a great renovation in. We put Salamander Grill in, and it's a big fire pits and redid all the rooms, and it's just the property's never looked better.
Hey, we're due to come to Virginia. We have several invitations. You'll have to give us another one, and then maybe we'll stir ourselves and get down
there. Sure. We'll have to get you out to the hotel. You'll love it.
If you were involved with the wood, and you're now in D.C., you're not that far away from Tarver King.
Yeah, I know Tarver very well.
Well, I met him at Somerville when he was his young 20s.
Oh, he's a very talented guy.
He's fabulous. He's going to be cooking in Pittsburgh.
We ate there twice.
Yeah, we did. And he's going to be cooking in Pittsburgh with a sort of a guest chef program. But it's only 40 seats and they're already sold out. So don't know. I'm trying to get an interview out of him anyhow. Well, be sure to put us in touch. I'll just email you and get Sheila's contact information.
Sure,
and that'd be
fun.
I've always wanted to interview her, but
she's a very exciting woman. She's a great lady.
I would say so. She's
absolutely
still doing horses.
Very dynamic and very, very, very passionate about what she's doing right now. It's wonderful.
She had a daughter. She had a daughter who was very equestrian.
Paige, yes,
okay. Still is.
Her name is Paige.
Okay,
and her son is Brett. And there's a great family, and so they're good folks. So when you come down, let's talk about getting you out there.
Okay, and also I want, before you get off, I want you to tell us about your involvement with Michelle Obama's Healthy Kids Initiative.
Okay, well, back in 2010, kicked off Seth's Move to School Initiative, Sam Cass and myself and the First Lady on the South Lawn of the White House, and I was privileged to get the opportunity to speak to a group of 700 chefs.
Were involved with that project, okay.
Yeah, and that's where it all started. And to get chefs to get into schools and take on their charter schools and public schools and try to get some awareness as to what food should be and the way we should be eating and to start doing a real grassroots approach to teaching these children,
you know
what good food is, and as they get older, to make the decisions that will make them healthier and keep them smarter and make them live longer and to eat healthier. And that spreads into the home, and it's been fabulous. And we've spread the word nationally, and it's going. It's even going internationally now. And did some work with down in the Caribbean the last two Aprils at the St. Croix Food and Wine Festival.
Okay.
And speaking with the University of St. Croix, and teaching the children about agriculture and growing, and starting gardens in their schools, and it's wonderful. And we've made some great progress, and we're on a big push right now. And I will actually be speaking in Canada with a group of chefs, and I'm going to speak very much in the same vein about the education aspect, from a chef to young audience of high school kids.
Well, I think it's absolutely fabulous, and the concept is wonderful. I have only one critique about it, is that I think that before you send these chefs out as ambassadors to the schools, you make sure they're in shape and they're not obese.
Well, for sure. You're exactly right. That's why you got to emphasize the exercise, and for sure you can't have an overweight chef out there. And that's why I'm on a constant diet. You're always trying to avoid all the challenges of working in the kitchen.
Yeah.
But it's tough, but you always got to try to get exercise every day. I ride my bike to and from work every day and try at least get exercise 4 or 5 days a week. But yes, I agree with you 100% there. It's always good to be a positive role model, not only by your passion and your occupation, maybe, and what you do, but from a physical appearance. So, and I think the First Lady is a great role for that. I think
she's great.
She's in great shape, and she's very active, and so is the President. So I think they send the right message there.
Well, you're a delight to talk to, Chef Todd Gray, and thank you for sharing your insights into the program with us and your culinary tour and all the fish camps of the West Coast. You made it sound so exciting, and hopefully we'll see you soon, huh?
I look forward to it, and thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
One more time, a happy Thanksgiving to all of our listeners who celebrate that holiday, and we hope you'll join us again same time, same place next week, and until then,
bye-bye.